You are listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, or MMNHD. In this episode, we speak with Robert Hockett, Edward Cornell Professor of Law at Cornell Law School. At Cornell, Hockett teaches and writes about organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics. He's also worked as fellow for the Century Foundation and as a consultant to a number of international financial institutions and state legislatures. His publications include several essays that will be of interest to listeners of this podcast, including his essay for the Cornell Law Review, titled The Finance Franchise, which he co-authored with Saul T. Almarova, as well as his recent article for Forbes, titled The Green New Deal, How We Will Pay For It Isn't a Thing, and Inflation Isn't Either. We talk with Bob a bit in this episode about his conception of finance as a franchise. But as you might guess, we're most interested in chatting with him about the Green New Deal and the role he has played and continues to play in Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's congressional campaign. Special thanks to Bob and also to Alex Williams for producing this episode. Bob Hockett, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Can you start by telling us a bit about your scholarly and professional background, including a bit about your experience as a political and economic advisor in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, sure. So my academic sort of expertise is mainly in the realm of business and finance, but from a sort of a lefty point of view, I suppose you could say, or a progressive point of view. It was a commitment to social justice, actually, that got me into the kind of business and finance curriculum in the first place. What made me decide actually to go to law school in the first place and to get a business degree as well, or just basically to do work in law and finance, was a bunch of time that I spent living under a bridge with a homeless group. And a couple of things sort of emerged from that experience. One was that they effectively had a kind of homeless kibbutz that combined work with life. And it sort of struck me at the time that, you know, it's odd that we don't actually have a business form of that sort here in the States as a kind of off the rack available form. And then, of course, another thing that struck me is they didn't have access to any kind of banking or financial services. So we sort of started an experiment together where I ran a little thing I called the shoebox bank for them. They ended up saving up quite a bit of money, several of them, enough to pay union dues and become union workers. So that was sort of a successful experiment. And I was thinking, well, I wonder why we don't have something like this already. Why aren't there shoebox banks all over the place? And again, why aren't there kibbutzim? So that got me thinking from a kind of social justice point of view about business forms, enterprise organization, finance, and the like. Around the same time, I was thinking I could be of more use to my friends under the bridge if I had some kind of a vocational degree, either law or finance or both. Whereas, you know, before meeting these friends, that would have been anathema to me. I never thought I would be interested in a vocational degree. That just seemed very, kind of sordid. But I realized it's actually useful. And so I ended up going ahead and getting those particular degrees, but always with that kind of social justice background in mind. And then when I went on the market to teach, you know, I thought I was going to have a problem, a sort of a neither fish nor fowl problem, because usually those who sort of offer to teach in the kind of business and financial law curriculum, or at least oftentimes, they're sort of industry apologists, or at the very least, they're sort of interested simply in how to regulate those particular realms, but not so much about how to use enterprise organization or finance as a kind of socially transformative practice. And so I didn't think I was going to do so well in the market, but I ended up, weirdly enough, doing pretty well, even though I had this sort of, you know, private law head and public law heart. And so, you know, pretty shortly after that, once I started teaching, I started getting asked by fairly progressive legislators at the local level, state level, and federal level to sort of help out with various bits of legislation and expert testimony and that kind of thing. So over the last, I'd say, pretty close to the last decade, I've been doing a lot of that kind of thing for various legislators, again, at various levels of government. And most recently, I guess most of the work I've been doing has been drafting work and sort of initial consultation work followed by drafting work, I guess I should say, for Senator Sanders and Senator Warren, a bit for Senator Gillibrand, and a bit of work for Senator Brown as well. And then I fell in pretty quickly with the AOC team on the House side back during the autumn during the campaign. So I got to sort of working with them as well, starting in a pretty big way in early December. and have been doing so ever since. So that's sort of a link, I guess you could say, between the kind of practical legislative type work or program design or policy design work that I do on the one hand, and my academic work on the other hand, all sort of stemming from that wonderfully, you know, seminal period living under a bridge for several years with a group of homeless guys.
Great. So we've asked you here to talk to us about the Green New Deal. So maybe to get us going, you can kind of introduce our listeners to what the Green New Deal is, where it came from, what it's becoming, and then maybe a little bit about how you have personally put your stamp on this policy idea.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for asking that. So, as you know, as you guys, of course, know, it's a very ambitious plan. It's and the sort of the resonance with the name of the original New Deal is quite intentional. And then, of course, the use of the word green is quite intentional, too. So our thought, there's sort of basically, there are two sort of big thoughts that I think have gone into the sort of conception and then the sort of formation or articulation of the Green New Deal ambition. The first is that the entire economy is in need of drastically in need of a truly deep and far-reaching overhaul of a sort that really should have been pursued right after the crash of 2008, if not before. I mean, at the very least, it was obvious after the crash of 2008 that there are fundamental structural problems with our economic arrangements that actually cry out for a radical revamping, a radical restructuring on the one hand. That has still not happened. Here we are 10 years later. And then second, of course, as we know, the globe itself, the planet itself, the human race, indeed most forms of animal life that we're familiar with, are under significant existential even threat in light of recent data that's come out that tells us that we've got 10 to 12 years left to turn around the climate change problem before reaching a kind of tipping point where there's no real return in prospect. So these are two massive challenges. And then, you know, lo and behold, this is sort of capital P providential looking. There's one particular policy initiative that we can take that addresses both of those problems in one fell swoop, right? That basically simultaneously addresses both of these essentially existential challenges that we face. And that is a massive overhaul of the entirety of the economy, the way in which we do production, the way in which we structure productive relations, the way in which we structure the infrastructure itself that sort of underlies or undergirds or frames productive relations. And in doing that, of course, one of the things you want to do is to use state-of-the-art techniques and state-of-the-art modes of production and productive arrangement. And as it happens, the state-of-the-art now just is green, right? So if you're really seriously doing an overhaul and really seriously doing a restructuring, then you are also doing a greenification, right? So it's a kind of, you know, this is an ugly metaphor because I don't like to harm birds, but it's a kind of two birds with one stone kind of thing, you know what I mean? That's the sort of the basic idea. So a little bit more detail, maybe it's we're thinking of it as being New Deal-like in the sense that we really are thinking in terms of a massive mobilization of the kind that we haven't seen, a concerted mobilization of a kind that we haven't seen in this country or this economy since the original New Deal itself and, of course, the Second World War mobilization. And that's sort of where the New Deal resonance comes from, at least that's part of where it comes from. And then, of course, it's green for the reason in the way or in the sense that I just sort of suggested, that if you're really going state of the art, then you are just by definition in doing that going green, because that is the state of the art where productive technologies and infrastructural technologies are concerned now. Maybe one final point in this connection, because this is another link with the original New Deal that I think tends to be overlooked or underplayed. And that is that, you know, the New Deal itself was not just one big massive 3,000 page statute like the Affordable Care Act or the Dodd-Frank Act or something like that. In effect, the New Deal was a decade-long national deliberation and national experimentation that basically took the form of a sequence of many, many, many statutory enactments and B, an ongoing national deliberation in connection with each of those discrete enactments. So in effect, you had a kind of a gigantic national town hall meeting that was going on for 10 to 12 years during the original New Deal. I guess the population at the time was, what, about 140 million or so. So about 140 million people, in theory, were part of this deliberation. Now, I say in theory, of course, because as we know, people who weren't white males were by and large excluded at that time. But in our view, that was a bug, not a feature of the New Deal. In other words, there was nothing essentially racist there was nothing about the original New Deal that had to be racist or sexist. It's just that there were a whole lot of bloody racists and sexists in the country in those days. And so, of course, they gave you programs that had racist elements. But our thought is that the country is rather less racist and sexist now, even though it still has a long way to go. And so this next New Deal, this second New Deal, this Green New Deal, will be much less racist and sexist than the original one. But that being said, we want to replicate that idea of a kind of an ongoing national deliberation and a very sort of experimentalist, pragmatist unfolding of the thing. You know, the thing that people forget about the original New Deal is the sort of experimental spirit in which it was conducted. So, you know, you would try something out, and if it didn't work, you would quickly discard it and try something else. And anytime something did seem to work, then you'd say, excellent, let's scale that one up. And we hope and plan to do the same thing, those of us who are involved in the Green New Deal, with the Green New Deal.
What would you say might be your contribution to the framing of the Green New Deal?
So it's hard to kind of put my finger on just one thing because the process, although I will try, but the reason it's a little difficult to do this is that the process has been very sort of open-ended and very, you know, kind of non-proceduralist, you might say, even though it has been a process. In other words, there hasn't been like some sort of a strict division of labor pursuant to which we say, all right, you handle this kind of stuff because you're the expert on this, and then somebody else, you handle that. But insofar as there have been, you know, sort of some maybe contributions that I've been trying to make that are maybe not unique to me, but that I've sort of tended to emphasize the most. One is by focusing on first this kind of processual nature of the original New Deal and the Second World War mobilization, right? Sort of focusing on the sense in which it's more a process than just it's at least as much a process as it is a set of products, that basically the New Deal is never a done, the New Deal was never a done deal, and the Green New Deal will never be a done deal either. It's processual as well. Second, the sense in which we really are talking about a mobilization, like what specifically that means, right? To use the word mobilization in this context and why it's necessary, and also what distinguishes a policy initiative that involves mobilization of this sort from policy initiatives that don't. So that involves some sort of economic theorizing of a sort, right, where you're basically trafficking in or channeling orthodox understandings of market failure on the one hand, but also broadening out those understandings a bit to sort of encompass more failures that more market failures that haven't been sort of canonically singled out by orthodox economists, who, of course, as we all know, tend to overlook certain things from time to time. And then I've tried to do a good bit on the financing side, because that's a particular area of expertise of mine, basically public finance, public accounting, but also the relations between the public sector and the private sector in the constituting of the financial system itself, right? So a lot of the work that I've done previously and that I continue to do in that realm about sort of how the financial system works and the sort of franchise nature of it, which, as you guys know, I'm sort of associated with, that's, of course, played a role in what I've been contributing to the process as well.
So it seems to me, and I was wondering if you could reflect on this for a little bit, that the naming as the New Deal and evoking that history as a memory for this project is sort of calling on actually two moments, right? I mean, you mentioned the experimentation and the broad-scale institutional projects that the New Deal sort of offers historically, but there's also the war mobilization. And it seems like I sometimes will hear supporters of the Green New Deal evoke the real stakes of this project and the level of this mobilization, and call upon the war mobilization and perhaps the Nazis themselves as climate change, metaphorically anyway. And I was wondering if you could reflect on that for a little bit, perhaps the differences or the benefits of doing one or the other.
Yeah. So I think, we're very serious about the Second World War analogy, as well as the original New Deal analogy. And there are a number of reasons for that, or a number of sort of bases, I think, for playing up that analogy, or even just spotting that analogy and then emphasizing it. So one is that, and it really kind of goes to this idea of mobilization that I was talking about before. Sometimes a problem that you face is so big that the only way that you can actually address it is indeed, right, to mobilize all sectors of a society or all sectors of an economy or both, around a particular initiative. And it seems that historically what generally has been required, maybe social psychologically speaking, to make that kind of mobilization possible has been war itself, right? I mean, I guess there aren't many things that are more existential than war, because it's pretty much about death, right? And mass death at that. And so, we've been thinking about, what the great American philosopher, psychologist William James referred to as the moral equivalent of war. It's easy for people to kind of bandy around that phrase kind of in a half-hearted way, and then, basically drain it of meaning if you call everything like my toothache is the moral equivalent of war. But some things really are the moral equivalent of war. And I think maybe if you needed a working definition for what would count, it would be anything that is indeed existentially threatening, right? Something that threatens mass death or mass calamity in terms of, millions and millions of lives, let alone extinctions of species, including possibly even our own. It's pretty hard to outdo that, right? It's pretty hard to top the threat that the climate is facing, the threat that the planet is facing when it comes to the moral equivalent of war. Indeed, I think, I don't think this is a particularly controversial suggestion to make, that climate change right now is probably actually more threatening to Americans than even the Nazis were, given that the Atlantic Ocean was a pretty good barrier. It's partly about that then. We partly play up the Second World War mobilization idea because we're thinking that the threat that we're facing is on a par with that we faced at the time of the Second World War. And again, it's partly because we think that the mobilization that's required, the scale of the mobilization that's required, is similar. And then another similarity that I didn't sort of mention before is, this gets to sort of what we mean when we use the word mobilization in this context. It's not only about, of course, sort of bringing every sector of the economy or every sector of society sort of into the act. It's also about figuring out how to structure the relations among those distinct sectors or those distinct levels, as it were, of governance when it comes to sort of developing and pursuing the policy. And we're thinking truly that, obviously local governments, even neighborhoods, villages are going to have a very important role to play in determining the nature of specific Green New Deal projects. We're thinking then that state governments will also have to play a very important role, and likewise sort of regional compacts or regional sort of groupings of states. And then finally, at the sort of apex, at the sort of highest level of organization and the most exclusive level of collective action, not exclusive, I'm sorry, the most extensive or inclusive level of collective action, namely that of the federal government, it's going to have to play a critical role as well, both in financing and in kind of coordinating across regions and across states. And, that kind of comprehensiveness where you're including every level of government, every locality, every state, every regional grouping of states, and the federal government itself, and then also including, every subsector of the so-called private sector and many subsectors of the so-called public sector all together as one big orchestra, with the federal government acting sort of as a conductor with a baton, but not the only instrument player. That's another sense in which we're talking about something that's really almost sui generis, with very, very few exceptions in our history. And those exceptions, again, have typically involved war, like the time of the Civil War or the Second World War, to a certain extent, even the First World War. And then, of course, the original New Deal itself.
And so just to, I think, just to put a finer point about what you're saying, it seems like at once the program is calling on both legacies of the Green New Deal and the war, but I sort of appreciate the way it's emphasizing the Green New Deal as a process of doing what we need to do to mobilize for, obviously, for the existential crisis, but also for its own sake. And so, if you know, I feel like typically the liberal imaginary is one that really only understands public mobilization on the terms of destruction and war. And it seems like what the Green New Deal is doing is sort of leveraging that imagination with a dual historical memory toward something, building something rather than destroying it.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. Beautifully put, Max. I mean, so that is another piece of this. You guys probably heard in the lovely 2.5 hour conversation I had with my friends over at Left Anchor, we talked about sort of the instrumental value of a decade long national deliberation on how to deliver ourselves from climate evil, but also about the sort of the intrinsic value that comes of a project like this, right? This could, in theory, be transformative of our polity, even once we have, quote unquote, solved the climate problem, because our thought, at least, is that this is going to sort of develop a kind of national habit of broad public deliberation where we really are all contributing and we really are all making suggestions and we really are all sort of debating, but in a spirit of cooperation and good faith, that is itself part of what it is to be human. And it's certainly part of what it is to be a republic as we claim to be. And of course, as you guys know, we've been anything but a republic in substance over the last number of decades in that, you know, it's not really public deliberation when people are just shooting tweets around and then, you know, sort of telling lies on television all the time. We want there to be an actual deliberation where there's something that actually approximates thought going on. And in that Left Anchor chat, you know, I sort of analogized the individual citizen to a sort of a neuron, right? You could almost say that we are, as a polity, a kind of a big neural network or one big political brain, as it were. And you need all of the neurons firing for the thing to work right. And our thought is that if we do this right and do it well over the coming decade, that habit will be so people will appreciate the experience of that to such a degree and appreciate the kind of intrinsic value of it to such a degree that probably they would continue in the habit even after this particular problem looks to be more or less solved for now, right? At least that's the hope, right? That's part of the actuating ambition here too. And in that sense, this is another opportunity, right, to get the New Deal right, right? The original New Deal had a lot of that, but it excluded people of color almost entirely, not quite entirely, but pretty close to it. And it excluded women almost entirely, even if not quite entirely, since Frances Perkins played such a critical role in building the New Deal itself. We thought there were little sort of seeds of truly comprehensive national deliberation in the original New Deal, but that weren't given enough water or nourishment, as it were, because Franklin Roosevelt had to, you know, compromise with all of these assholes in the South, right? These Southern Democrats in order to get, you know, kind of the New Deal through. And the great thing now is that all of those assholes are basically Republicans. we'll cut that. That's unnecessarily provocative right now. But it's basically not necessary to sort of placate racists in a way that it probably wasn't really necessary even back then, but at least an argument could be made for it. I don't think that Roosevelt said in bad faith or decided in bad faith that he had to placate Jim Crow Southern Democrats in those days. He might have been wrong about it, but I think he meant it. But now I don't think you can even say that and mean it in good faith. I think there's just absolutely no reason that you have to placate people like that. And indeed, people like that can't even sort of say what they really think in public unless they're on Fox News, I guess. So, you know, I think we can do it better this time. You know, one other thing, if I could just quickly throw this in, that was cool about the original New Deal that we want to replicate here, and this is something that has either been forgotten by most people or never was known by some people. The original New Deal had projects in literally every congressional district of the country, right? And that it could have been a red Republican district or a blue Democrat or a purple. Any district that it was, there was some kind of New Deal project going on. Now, that is on the one hand politically savvy and smart. You know, it's a way of getting by, and that's how the defense industry operates after all, and look how well it does in getting contracts. But it's also, you know, quite apart from that particular sort of instrumental value, that too has an interest intrinsic value, you know, we have a word for it. We call it justice, right? Or we call it democracy, right? If the New Deal is meant to be for everybody, then it really ought to be doing stuff for everybody. And that means, among other things, doing stuff in every district. And our thought is that that's another sense in which this is a kind of, this is a wonderful opportunity to do something truly transformative and that might actually finally end certain forms of bad faith gridlock or bad faith atavism, you know, in our national political process. Because if even Republicans are benefiting by this in their capacities as human beings who live in congressional districts, at least, you would think that that might mute at least some of the more bad faith attempts to sabotage the Green New Deal once it's underway.
Speaking a little bit more about good faith and bad faith arguments, and returning also to the the moral equivalent, the question of the moral equivalence of war and the climate crisis. One of the obstacles that doesn't tend to face people who are advocating for war and mobilizing is how are you going to pay for that? But that comes up all the time in the context of the Green New Deal. And of course, we know that modern monetary theory has some ideas about how you would pay for that and ideas about the question itself. Could you say a little bit about the role you see MMT playing, where it fits into the picture here?
So, you know, there are a couple of several different angles, I suppose, from which to approach the question, right? And so maybe I'll just sort of take them quickly in sequence. So the first is, you know, there must be some way to pay for it because we paid for it for the Second World War and we paid for it during the original New Deal itself. So and it would be kind of weird, right, for anybody to say, well, you know, we used to be able to do big things back in the 1930s when the country was prostrate, right? was prostrate and then sort of, you know, knocked on its back by the Depression. Or, you know, oh, we were really good at doing stuff when we had like 5,000 planes being produced per year against Nazis who were producing, many thousands more. But we just can't do that now, even though we're a global hegemon now that we in the way that we weren't back then. So as a first pass, you know, the first thought is, well, there must be some way to do it. And then a next pass is, well, how did we do it? And how do we pay for stuff now? And, you know, the sort of short answer, as we've all talked about before, is you pay for it like you pay for anything else, right? Congress appropriates funds and you spend the funds, right? There's no particular constraint of a kind of financial sort when it comes to funding or financing or paying for things like this. Insofar as there would be any possible constraint, it would be, of course, what our friends in the MMT movement call the resource constraint. And that means in turn then that what we really are wanting to know is whether there might be an inflationary threat, not whether there's a what if people stop lending to you, because we don't have to borrow from anybody to do this, at least as a matter of sort of the fundamental structure of the universe or whatever, right? But then that leads to the third sort of form of set of observations that can be made in connection with that question. And that is, well, you know, is there a probable inflation problem? Is there some daunting looking inflation challenge ahead, blah, blah, blah. And there's a, you know, many, many, many part answer to this. You guys know I put out a piece in Forbes about a month and a half ago that was meant to be a kind of a comprehensive, you know, point by point by point consideration of the various reasons that we might worry or decide not to worry about inflation. And, you know, one could spend a good bit of time repeating them all here, but I'll start simply by way of a quick disclaimer, just referring people to the article in case I leave anything out here. It's just the Forbes piece called, you know, The Green New Deal, How We Pay For It Is Not a Thing and Neither Is Inflation, something like that. Just Google Forbes and my name and a thing and you'll find it. But to my immense surprise, some 50 or 60,000 reads are on there now. I guess a lot of people have read it for some reason. I guess it struck a nerve or something. But in any event, the thing to say about this, I think, one thing to start with is to note that this is a case where scale, the sheer size, which is the thing that a lot of the right wingers are saying is what makes it impossible or infeasible. This is why it's unaffordable, is because it's so big. Ironically, the size in this case is something that I think makes it more affordable, by which I mean something that makes inflation less likely. And the reason for that is that we really are talking about a massive boost in the productive capacity of this economy and in this economy's capacity to produce new products, new goods and services of a kind that are not available at this point on anything like the scale we're talking about. All of the green technologies that we're talking about include among them lots of individually used green technologies like solar panels for people's homes, battery-powered cars, batteries themselves for the battery-powered cars, and so on and so forth. And the basic idea here then is if we always keep in mind, as I keep liking to say just because it's a nice easy nursery rhyme to remember, inflation is a relation. Right, so think of the relation between the amount of money on the one hand and the amount of goods and services that can be purchased with that money on the other hand. Inflation is only a problem when the money begins to grow, the supply of the money grows at a much more rapid clip than the supply of the goods and services. But that's exactly another reason to scale up here, because if we're really talking about a massive boost in the production of things that can be bought and sold, that offsets, of course, the infusion or the injection of additional money into the economy to absorb it, meaning you don't actually get the inflationary pressures in the first place. Whereas by contrast, if you spent one-tenth as much as what we have in mind with the Green New Deal, but didn't bring about any significant or substantial boost to the productivity of the country, you'd be much more likely to get some sort of an inflationary pressure out of that than you would out of what we're talking about. So that's sort of the first point when it comes to the inflation constraint here. The second point is we know how to deal with inflation, right, if it ever were to happen. I mean, there are lots of modes, right? And as we know, you know, taxation of various kinds is one mode, but there's so many more. And as a finance regulation teacher, right, as a professor of financial regulation in particular, I can rattle off a million different ways to deal with inflation that don't even involve taxation at all, right? For example, leverage requirements or liquidity requirements are classic time-honored means. And then, you know, add to that the fact that, well, when was the last time there actually was inflation of any significant sort, of a generalized sort, at least in the goods and services markets as distinguished from the financial markets in this country? Well, it was like back in the 70s, right? I mean, so, and, you know, in the meanwhile, right, we had the Bush administration spend something like $5 trillion or more on completely unproductive wars that did nothing to boost the quantum of goods and services available for purchase in our economy, and yet didn't generate any inflationary pressure in the goods and services markets. And then, of course, we had that absurd Trump and Republican caucus tax cut of December 2017 of another, what, $2 to $2.5 trillion. That doesn't seem to have sparked any significant inflation. The Fed, for 10 years as a de facto matter and for 7 years as a de jure matter, has been trying to target a 2% inflation rate from below, and they've only managed to get it up to 2% several quarters in these last 10 years. So, you know, my thought is, okay, yeah, if you're worried about inflation, you know, call us up when you see it. But, you know, it's been nowhere in sight. There's not even a spread, right, between inflation-protected Treasury securities on the one hand and non-inflation-protected Treasury securities on the other. And all these Republicans who are always saying, well, you're going to have inflation, they're the same people who say that you can trust markets to kind of get things right. Well, the markets are telling us that there is no foreseeable inflation because the markets are not giving any premium for inflation-protected Treasury bonds. So I just think that there's simply – this is just a, truly a great big nothing for now. And again, we can spot this sort of stuff emerging well in advance of its truly becoming a problem if it ever does become one. But until there's some sign of that, it just seems to me it's ridiculous. It's just basically self-hamstringing. It's like tying our hands behind our back anytime anybody wants to do something useful or productive, and then untying the hands as soon as they want to do something destructive and harmful, meaning, in other words, that the Republicans are all basically MMTers without calling themselves that, and the Democrats have all been crazy Republican Simon Legree Austerians. And it's just like, what's wrong with this picture, right? In a word, everything.
Right. So it seems like there's two ways to talk about where MMT fits into this conversation, at least two coming to mind. One is the one that you've been answering to, which is sort of, you know, what kind of tools does MMT and adjacent heterodox economic and legal schools permit us to use in order to answer these questions, right? In order to mobilize the collective in the way we'd like to for the Green New Deal. I think a second question is a question that interests us equally, if not even more, on this show, Money on the Left, which is about truly getting over the Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative paradigm, which for us means revealing the public character and structure of money as a social relationship and revealing its plasticity and ultimately its inalienability. And we know from your work that it, in your own language and in your own ways, this is something that interests you as well. And it seems like so far you've been enlisted in the AOC Green New Deal team to answer the first question, right? The how are we going to pay for it? Well, let me tell you, and I'll tell you about inflation, and we can explain this, right? But then there's the question of this mobilization being an incredible opportunity to raise consciousness and to transform not just the productive infrastructure, but our own collective perception of, relation to, and practice of finance and banking. And I was wondering if you could maybe share with us some of your ideas about this, maybe from your own work, and how this might fit into a Green New Deal project, even if it's not, admittedly, right now, what we're leading with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. No, that's a great question, Scott. Thanks. So this is one of the things I find most exciting about the movement as it has emerged, and most exciting about the fact that the Congresswoman is not only, of course, an architect of the Green New Deal, but also serving on the House Financial Services Committee with Maxine Waters, for whom I've also done a great deal of work in the past. So just this past Tuesday, I spent the entire day writing up a million questions for the Congresswoman to pose to the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, because she was going to be part of those hearings on Wednesday. Now, the leadership decided to deploy her formidable skills in questioning Mr. Cohen instead, meaning that all of those questions I wrote up on Tuesday ended up not being useful this week. But they've assured me they're going to use them next time around. One of the things I tried to do in those questions was to sort of draw out a broader and fuller picture of what our financial system really is at bottom and can be made on the surface in a manner that makes the sort of surface reveal what the actual truth is at the bottom. And so I'm very excited about the relatively near-term future, about what we're going to be able to do on this score and what the Congresswoman is going to be able to do. Now, what is that vision, right? What is that? What is it that has me so excited, or that I was so excited to have an opportunity to kind of write a bunch of questions that are all designed to kind of lead the Fed chair to sort of acknowledge? Basically, something like this. As you know, Scott, through the Rousseauvian money paper that I think I sent you a while ago, and of course you've mm-hmm. read the Finance Franchise stuff and the Finance Without Financiers paper as well. As you know, my view is that the financial system itself is essentially a public thing, and it can be sort of vaguely hybridized if the public, which is at the center of it, delegates some of the credit checking function to, or some of the allocation function to private institutions. But even if it does, in a case like that, then it's basically a kind of public-private franchise arrangement whereby the public, the sovereign public, is the franchisor, as it were. The franchised good is the monetized full faith and credit of the sovereign public. And then the franchisees are these licensed private institutions that are licensed specifically to allocate this particular resource, this particular good. And we only keep them on, we only outsource that allocation function if it actually proves to make sense, if they do a good job of it. And if they're doing a better job of it than simply bringing the operations back in-house would do. Now, I've got a paper coming out very shortly. I'll send you the draft of it. It's called The People's Ledger. This is sort of a sequel of sorts to the finance franchise and to the Roussovian money paper about basically fully designing what an entirely public central banking system would work, whereby basically all private banking branches that we know and love now with the teller windows and all that would basically just become branch offices of the Fed, and the Fed itself would be distributing or allocating credit, or would be branch offices of another public financial institution that I've been pushing for that we might talk about a little bit later. But in any event, we're not there yet. At the moment, we have this kind of franchise arrangement. Now, what does that mean and what are the implications? Well, I think ultimately, you know, the real key point to me is, you know, and I do this shtick all the time. I hope you guys will forgive me if you're sort of bored with it. But you pull out a dollar bill and you look across the top and it says Federal Reserve Note. And if people, anybody who doesn't have a legal background might first think, well, what does that mean, note? That's like a note to my girlfriend or something, or what is that? It's short, of course, for promissory note. So the Fed is issuing promissory notes, and that's a clue right off the bat that money has something to do with promising, something to do with credit, with credere, to believe, or credibility. But the other thing that's kind of even cooler is, now if you think about what happens when you go out and take out a loan at a private banking institution, the last document that you're going to, or the penultimate document that you're going to sign before everything is finalized, is also a promissory note, but it's your promissory note. So one way I like to describe what happens is, you know, Scott Ferguson goes over to the bank if he has to borrow money, and he signs a promissory note. It's a Scott note, and he basically swaps it temporarily for a Fed promissory note. And what the bank is the credit checking institution. It just makes sure that this is a good bet for the Fed, basically temporarily trading in private promises for public promises. And the reason we do that is the public promise gives you command over a greater variety of resources than your private promise does. And that in turn is simply because not everybody knows Scott Ferguson, right? If we could get the entire 340 million people in the United States to know Scott Ferguson, we know that they would love him and trust him. And then Scott notes would be as fungible and as usable as claims upon resources as Fed promissory notes. But it's kind of hard to introduce Scott to the entire 340 million Americans. And so what we do instead is we use the Fed promissory notes to do that. Those I think of as sort of our collective promissory notes. And what we do, and I'm very big on this collective we, on the first person plural, what we as a polity have, or as a republic, have decided to do is to disseminate public promissory notes that basically represent our promises in our collective capacity as one great big political we. And we've said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to confer those public promises, which function as claims on resources, to individuals temporarily in return for their private promissory notes if they can convince some banking institution that they have a good idea that they can basically make material, that they can materialize by being given that temporary command over resources that is the public promise, right? The public promissory note. And so it's a temporary swap, right? Now, insofar as that's the nature of what's actually going on here, insofar as that's what the financial system is ultimately doing, it seems to me that there are some implications when it comes to optimization, right? One is, why do the swaps always have to be temporary? Or why do they even always have to be swaps? Why can't it be the case, for example, in the midst of some deep, deep liquidity trap that calls for some kind of QE, why can't there be a kind of a QE for the people whereby the public simply drops the helicopter money on individual citizen accounts rather than dropping the helicopter money on banks, on basically go-between institutions, and hopes that they'll lend handed on to individuals? That's the first question. And then the second question is, even when you do want to do it in a kind of a lending way, even when you do want to do it in the kind of swappy kind of way, is it really necessary to delegate that kind of allocation function, that credit checking function, to private franchisee institutions? Can't it also maybe be done and be done better and more equitably and more more justly and even in some ways more productively if it's done by branches of the Fed rather than private franchisees of the Fed? We've got this weird dogma that only private sector actors are capable of making good credit allocation decisions because they're under the constraint of, you know, the discipline of the market and so forth. But that's bullshit. We know that because there's basically no discipline in the banking markets. And furthermore, you know, you don't really need a profit to have discipline. You could impose a break-even requirement, for example, on Fed branches. Let's say every private banking branch, like, you know, the teller, you go to the, I don't know, the Chase Bank branch over on the corner of Wall and William downtown where I live in New York, and you just replace that with a Fed branch instead of a Chase branch. And you say, okay, Chase branch, you're going to be a credit allocator now in the way that, I'm sorry, a Fed branch, you're going to be a credit allocator in the way this Chase branch was. And instead of being under a profit-making constraint, you're basically under a break-even constraint. Think about how much more lending would be done that could be productive if the constraint were simply break even or don't lose too much rather than, oh, let's maximize profits for some fucking shareholders who own this thing. Sorry, I shouldn't say fucking shareholders, but we've got this like ridiculous myth, right, that somehow, that we have to sort of outsource the allocation function even if we keep the what I call the modulation function, basically the quantity of money determination function in-house within the Fed. And I think that's just not true. And a lot of my more recent work is devoted to sort of showing precisely the sense in which that's not true and explaining why it's not true. And once we realize that it's not true, there's pretty much no reason at all not to bring it all in-house and just have, since it's the public's money anyway, it's the public's resource, it's the monetized full faith and credit of the United States that's being disseminated by this system anyway, there's no need. If there's no need to sort of outsource the allocation function with respect to this resource to private entities, well then, you know, let's bring it back in-house and let's do the allocating publicly just like we do the modulating publicly. And as Scott knows, I mean, one of my favorite slogans of late that I've been pushing is I've been saying, you know, good modulation actually requires good allocation. So if the private sector is fucking up the allocation, that makes even the modulation function that we've kept in-house on the in the public sector much more difficult to do right. So if we actually take over allocation again as a public, we'll do our modulation better, which is just another way of saying no more bubbles, no more busts, much more productivity, much more actual investment in the productive sectors of the economy rather than those where people are simply gambling on price movements in secondary and tertiary markets.
Yeah, and I can say, or it seems to me at least, that these Fed banks wouldn't even necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, need to break even. They can operate at a loss. The question is not whether they're quote-unquote losing money. The question is, are they serving public purposes? I mean, if they're doing a terrible job and nothing gets produced, that to me would be the reason to sanction them or to, you know, clean them up. But, the fiscal budget, you know, we know almost always is in deficit. And if we think of a consolidated FISC in which the banking sector is essentially just an extension of the public purse, then we can kind of let go of that.
That's a great point too, Scott. Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to have a break-even requirement, right? Or what you could do is if it freaks too many people out too much to go straight to the allowance for a kind of a permanent loss status because we just view it as a public cost, which is obviously endurable because, of course, the public cost is usually the private sector's gain, right? The public debt clock down in Union Square is basically the private wealth clock. Even if some people can't quite get that right away and we sort of start off with a kind of a break-even requirement, at some point, it shouldn't be that far away from now, and we should be able to make the case pretty clearly. I can't think of a better way to make it than the way you just now did, to say, you know, we don't even have to impose a kind of no loss or no net loss requirement or a break even requirement. We could just, we can even stomach or allow for a permanent deficit or quote unquote, you know, inverted commas loss position, if that means greater public, greater wealth out there, greater productivity, more good stuff, better lives for people in general. I fully agree. I think that's exactly right. Now, you know, you might have noticed, so getting back to your original question, you know, I didn't use the term MMT or modern money theory or anything in what I said just now. And what's kind of cool to me, at least, is, you know, I'm not a card-carrying MMTer because I've never been educated as an MMT economist in an economics department or what have you. My own economics training and finance training was done, unfortunately, mainly by orthodox types, although some of them are kind of at the margins of orthodoxy. Robert Shiller was one of my principal mentors. But what's kind of cool to me is that from a legal point of view, right, just as a lawyer, as somebody who understands the law of the Fed, the law of the Treasury, the law that goes into the constituting of the financial instruments that are traded on the financial markets, I basically arrive at the same position as the MMT, as our MMT friends arrive, from a somewhat different angle. And the way I view this is kind of cool, because what that means is we've got corroborative evidence for what our friends in the MMT movement have been putting forward for a long, long time, right? That, in other words, if there's a knowledge position that you can reach using the methodology or the mode of inquiry that is common in economics departments with MMT folk who are basically constituting those departments, and then if you can arrive at the same position starting as a lawyer slash financier, which is basically where I come from, that's a pretty good indicator that there's something true there, right? That there's that the MMTers have it right, because you don't even have to have been trained by the MMTers to have arrived at their position. And the way I think of it is basically, it's sort of no accident, right? I mean, one reason I think that our MMT friends have arrived at the right position here is because they are attentive to the actual institutions that constitute the money system. They're basically attentive to the ultimately legal nature of or character of money itself, and the political and state character of money itself. They're attentive to all that. They're also attentive to the actual operational realities of central banks and treasury departments in a way that that sort of high theory, sort of high church economic theorists have never been. So in a sense, the MMTers were kind of legal economists, even without realizing it, because they weren't lawyers. And somebody who comes from my point of view, or from some of our other friends like Rowan's point of view, arrive at the same way. We were sort of economists without fully realizing it as lawyers. And what it ultimately comes down to is that the law and economics here all are, it's like a mashup. They all go together, right? And so in a certain sense, what we've done is we've all sort of rediscovered from different angles the truth that the old legal realists were commonly associated with in the past, which is essentially the essential legal and political nature of an economy and of economic relations in the first place.
Yeah, that's great. And to circle back to another piece of my question, speaking to the issue of making money its structure, its public structure, its legal structure visible, right? And that's part of democratization. And I'm wondering if you could reflect on how something like a directly federalized banking system, whether it's at the level of legal architecture or it's at the level of individual and local communal experience, how do you see that potentially changing? Or can you talk about that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I guess the way I see things there is somewhat inchoately, in the sense that I've a picture seems to be emerging, in at least in my limited imagination, that's not fully filled in yet, but that is sort of seems to fill in more with each passing week or so, right? So if you sort of start at the top, there's an obvious reason to have at least one currency that is publicly issued and usable within the entirety of the territorial boundaries of the polity in question, right? But then a question emerges, and that is it possible that certain forms of wealth generation are not possible within certain localities with a national currency alone, right? Are there needs that are best addressed or best dealt with by supplementing the national currency arrangement with local currency arrangements? Now, the answer to that question right now is obviously yes, because the way things are now, the city of Ithaca, for example, where I spend 2 or 3 days a week when school is in session, as you know, has kind of famously had its own currency at various times in its history. And what that currency has done is basically made up for the fact that there have been times when there has been too little federal currency in Ithaca, right? Too little federally generated money in Ithaca. And yet there's lots of pent up capacity to produce and to add value to the lives of one another in Ithaca that are sort of left pent up or left bottled up until that genie can be let out of the bottle with some other kind of currency that we don't have to wait for the feds to sort of generate to use. And so local currencies or community currencies, alternative currencies of this sort, I think of them as basically keys to, you know, sort of open, they're sort of like corkscrews that open up bottles that are full of local value that can't yet be tapped because there is not the wherewithal to get enough of the national currency into the community in question to do that unbottling or uncorking. And so given that fact, my initial, you know, the first thought is, well, you know, if we make the federal currency system sort of more transparently public, or even if everybody becomes more cognizant of the fact that it's our money, as it were, it's still possible that there's going to be that kind of pent up value in communities that would call for the issuance of local currencies or community currencies or complementary currencies too. On the other hand, a kind of a counter thought to that comes to mind is that if we actually did all get clear together or all get transparent together on the essentially public nature of our currency, the dollar, I imagine that a lot of the reasons that account for the shortage of dollars in various communities would dissipate, would go away, right? In other words, if we democratize the dollar more fully and didn't entrust private banking institutions alone as the sole disseminators of those dollars as our franchisee institutions, but rather brought the allocation function back in-house in the sense that you would have Fed branches disseminating the dollar and doing so not under a profit constraint anymore, but under at most a break-even constraint and possibly not even under that because of the reasons that you gave before, Scott, it could very well be that bottled up value problem would go away on that account already so that you wouldn't actually even need the complementary currencies. And to me, this is sort of an empirical question, right? In other words, it seems to me that it's at least theoretically possible that fully democratizing the central bank and bringing fully making public, you're basically, again, bringing the franchisee functions back in-house might actually take care of the bottled up value problem within localities such that you wouldn't even need complementary currencies. But it's also possible that there's some inherent problem with that you need to have some kind of locally issued currencies in some localities, even with a more fully democratized Fed. And to my mind, that looks to me kind of an empirical question. It's a sort of a wait and see thing, right? Mm-hmm. My guess is you get a lot of bang for the sort of pun foreseen, but not quite intended. You got a lot of bang for the buck by bringing the banking functions, the allocation functions back in-house with the Fed. And the only real question is, do you get so much bang for that buck that you don't even need complementary currencies any longer? As things currently stand, I think there's simply no question but that you need complementary currencies because these private banking institutions are not locally responsive in the way they used to be and because they have to make profits according to their shareholders. And so there's lots of credit money that just does not get generated or disseminated in little localities like Ithaca. And so you need some alternative source, some alternative way to monitor monetize people's value-adding capacities.
And so perhaps we can put on our Marxist caps for a bit, even though I think we've already been indulging in that side of ourselves already. And maybe reflect on the historical conditions from which the fight for the Green New Deal has now emerged. And in the spirit of the Communist Manifesto and perhaps even a little bit of the reflexivity of the 18th Brumaire, can we consider how we got here and what can be said about the historical opening that presents itself today?
Yeah, I think we can. In my humble opinion, it looks to me, at least, like what's been happening in this country for the last 40 to 50 years, if not longer, has been essentially the coming to pass of pretty much everything that Marx and Engels predicted, right? So remember, they were skeptical about the capacity of a democratic polity democratically to sort of counteract the tendency of capital to concentrate it up at the top into fewer and fewer hands up at the top of the distribution. And they were skeptical of a democracy's capacity to prevent the ongoing immiseration of everybody who doesn't basically own the productive resources, or what they would have called, of course, the means of production. In effect, you know, the United States kind of temporarily proved them partly wrong, in the sense that the Wagner Act, other New Deal pieces of New Deal legislation did strengthen labor in such a way as to enable it to demand successfully and receive a much greater share of the national product, and thereby sort of stem the process of their own immiseration. And it kind of worked for a while, right? For at least two or three decades, even though there was constant pressure from capital to try to counteract all of that. But what seems to me to have happened is sometime in the late 1960s, maybe owing to the perceived excesses of the hippies. You know, my mom was one of those hippies who was constantly, you know, kind of throwing Molotov cocktails and stuff. And, you know, maybe there was like some kind of a national revulsion or something that people like Nixon and you know, Kevin Phillips, his political advisor, sort of successfully exploited, basically to kind of turn back or roll back all of the successes of organized labor and other previously marginalized constituencies. And what we saw from, you know, the 1970s all the way on down to 2008 was, you know, basically the rolling back or the elimination of labor's power to kind of grab a bigger piece of the national product. And we saw, you know, furthermore, of course, the outsourcing of production to, you know, kind of cheap labor districts or precincts abroad. And basically, you know, the course of history that Marx and Engels had prognosticated basically just continued along that original track and has for the last 40 or 50 years. Now, what the Green New Deal, it seems to me, offers, and what the changes in Congress or in the polity that are themselves making the Green New Deal countenanceable, to me, augurs or portends, is that the polity is becoming sort of energized again around a kind of recognition that there's something fundamentally fucked up about the current structures that all operate in a way that continues to concentrate the ownership of productive resources up at the top of the distribution. And, you know, one of the first signs of this, I think, was, of course, the Occupy movement. You guys probably, I think Scott at least knows that during the occupation, I was working at the New York Fed, but I would sort of basically, and the New York Fed is about two blocks from the Zuccotti Park. So I'd do my Fed job during the day. I'd walk over to the park after work, and I'd camp out at night, kind of reliving my experience under the bridge with my homeless friends, as it were. Then I'd go, you know, shower in the morning and change clothes, go back to the Fed and, you know, rinse and repeat. And we did this for like 2 months. And what really emerged very clearly at the park, and then more farther, you know, farther in further precincts, was that the whole country was much more left-leaning than I think people had realized. It was almost like every one of us who was an egalitarian was kind of quiet about it or in the closet about it, because each of us thought that he or she was like the only one or one of a tiny group. And what the occupation seemed to sort of make clear was that actually there's a whole bunch of us who are thinking this way. And once you realize you're not the only one, or that you're not part of a tiny minority, but that you're actually probably part of the 99%, that emboldens you. Then, of course, the runaway bestseller status of Thomas Piketty's book a few years after that, that I don't think anybody anticipated, was another sign. Then, of course, Bernie announces in 2015, I signed on immediately and became this kind of finance regulatory spokesperson. And I did it because I just thought, oh, you know, this isn't going to go anywhere, but it's going to be valuable because it'll get some good arguments out there. It'll sort of broaden the menu of discussion. But no, we basically won, you know, and I think we actually would have literally won the primaries if there hadn't been those kind of shady disappearances of thousands of votes in Brooklyn for the New York primary and elsewhere. I don't want to sound too much like Oliver Stone, but I do think that there was a lot of, you know, skullduggery in that connection. But what we almost won it in 2016. And of course, the polls are now showing, right, that Bernie could beat Trump. So I think what's going on is that the polity has not only sort of become more energized, but it's become more conscious of its own power in the sense that all of us constituent members of this polity have come to recognize that we're not alone, that we actually are part of a very large group that is indeed the majority probably of the population, if not indeed a supermajority. And so we might once again be able to get ourselves onto a track where we sort of prove Marx and Engels to have been right with respect to tendencies, but wrong with respect to inevitability, right? And that's maybe just the metabolic optimist in me, right? But, you know, I can give you 1,000 reasons why everything I just now said is bullshit and we're all going to hell in a handcart. But I just, my body doesn't believe that, right? My body believes we're going to win. I think it's just, I have like an optimistic metabolism and I just think we're going to take this thing. And so in that sense, I think ultimately, I think I probably have more in common with Hilferding than with Marx and Engels, even though I cut my teeth as a youth on Marx and Engels and have been a sort of passionate devotee of Marx ever since I was 16. You know, I love him, and I read every biography that ever comes out about him, and he was right about so many things. But part of my life is devoted or dedicated to the proposition that he was right about a tendency but wrong about inevitability, and that the Hilferding vision can actually be realized. I always think of Hilferding's book as basically Capital Volume 5. If we agree that Theories of Surplus Value was Volume 4, then I think that Hilferding's Finance Capital is Volume 5, which says basically, as you guys know, that as an economy financializes and the commanding heights of the economy come to be concentrated in the financial sector, the idea of a public takeover of the entire economy peacefully becomes no longer a pipe dream, but a very easy thing to do, basically. And I think that, you know, the Fed is just like two steps away from being Hilferding's commanding height financial institution that runs the economy. And I think we should just take the final step. In a kind of a related note, I think I've told this to Scott before. I was at a conference once where some right-wing Virginia economist said that, you know, central banking is the last refuge of central planning. And I leapt up and said, that's right, guilty as charged, you know, and kind of waved my hand, because that's why I'm fascinated by central banking. That's why I started to work for the Fed, is it seems to me that we can actually rationally coordinate an economy from that kind of level through a gigantic public banking institution. Alexander Hamilton sort of knew that and saw that. So did his successor, Albert Gallatin. Unfortunately, you know, Andrew Jackson, you know, representing the Yahoo portion of the American polity, kind of nixed that. And it took us a while to kind of grope our way back in that direction. But we've been groping in that direction ever since. And I think we're pretty close to being there. And, you know, the Andrew Jackson descendants, the Yahoo Southerners, I shouldn't say Southerners, but the Southern Democrat types, are still the principal obstacle. But those people are really rapidly coming to be outnumbered, and they're actually, you know, they're not really good at social reproduction anymore, to use the Marxian category. As a demographic, they're kind of dying out and being replaced by people who are actually sensible and humane.
It also seems to me that that money and social and political consciousness about money plays a part in this story as well, right? So you have a long history of a public that is conscious and consciously politicizing the structure of money in this country. And one of the things that happens with the New Deal settlement, unfortunately, right, is that money increasingly ceases to be something that is up for grabs. And it just seems to me that with a lot of the pushback that happened in the 60s and 70s, the missing piece of the puzzle, at least in the collective consciousness, not to say there weren't people thinking about it, was the money question. I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think so. You know, it's really kind of interesting. This would be a great sort of historical study, I think, at least potentially. I have a conjecture, and I have a funny feeling you guys might find it intriguing too. And who knows, maybe one or more of you guys would like to work on a project together to see if we can kind of corroborate the truth or otherwise of this conjecture. So around the same time that the pushback against the Great Society and against the kind of Democratic Party ascendancy begins in the very late 1960s, a so-called revolution in financial theory begins to sort of gather steam. It kind of starts in 1963 with Sharpe and Lintner sort of developing early versions of the CAPM. But then as you kind of proceed into the later 60s and then especially into the early to mid 70s, you get all these ultimately, you know, fake Nobel Prize winning advances in financial theory. And so finance suddenly becomes, instead of a kind of a backwater vocational school sort of department at various universities, it becomes a very high church, highly mathematized, highly technical discipline that even some of the economists begin to envy rather than laughing at as mere vocational applied type stuff. So this revolution in financial theory, as they called it, actually brings about a real revolution on Wall Street, in the sense that all of the trading methods, most of the things that Wall Street does, come to sort of conform to or to sort of capitalize on, quite literally capitalize on, these new theoretical advances when it comes to pricing models, risk models, trading algorithms, and you name it. And that's really when the financialization of the economy begins to spike in a huge way as well. That's really when secondary market trading volume and tertiary market, i.e. derivatives market trading volume, begins to exceed and then to dwarf all activity, at least in nominal terms, all activity in the so-called real economy. Now, that, of course, is a pathology in its own right. But here's where it gets to your last observation, Scott. Another side effect of this particular sort of quote-unquote revolution in financial theory is not only that it changes the practice of finance in a manner that takes its attention off of the real economy and turns it makes it into something much more self-referential, where you're, again, just betting on price movements. It also makes finance suddenly look very inaccessible to ordinary Janes and Joes. It looks really, really, really technical, so that now the only people who can quote unquote talk about it are people who can mansplain to you. You know, sort of. Mm-hmm. So don't worry your pretty little head over this. This is like stochastic calculus stuff. You have to use the Ito calculus to understand this pricing model, cute little lady. So, you know, just don't worry your pretty little head over this shit. Let us do it. We specialize in shit. And you basically just focus on gay marriage and stuff, okay? And so what happens is you end up, you know, basically all of us lefties are kind of ghettoized, and we're told, okay, yeah, you guys, you can do your kind of cute little things about getting marriage equality and your cute little thing about getting, you know, sort of getting prayer out of schools and stuff, and you can do all that stuff. But leave this kind of heavy lifting, hardcore finance economic stuff to us, because as you can see, just open up any of these finance journals. Can you understand that stuff with all that symbolism, all that formalism? No, I bet you can't. It's because it's so technical. So let's leave it to us. And so what that does, of course, and since the financial system is the primary place at which money is generated and indeed allocated, you basically, in doing this, you take money away from the public, right? You've taken the whole idea of money. You've turned it into something that's somehow recondite, very recherché, and even scary, you know, because it's all about rocket science. And they even start giving themselves these self-flattering names, like, we're the rocket scientists, you know. And it's just total bullshit, right? None of that shit means anything. I mean, basically, if you really are getting right down to brass tacks, what's going on in the financial system is this public resource, again, the monetized full faith and credit of the United States, is being disseminated on a massive scale by public institutions to private institutions, which then purport to allocate this resource in an efficient way. But it's only efficient in the sense that it lines the pockets of the rich fucks who make use of this system. because all they're doing is betting on price movements, again, in secondary markets and third and tertiary markets, not actually investing in the real economy. And so that, to my mind, that's where the real severance, that's where the real the decisive sort of expropriation, you might say, of the entire public, of its money, and even of the epistemology of its money, occurs. And that all starts in a huge way in the late 60s, early 70s, which is the very same time that Nixon becomes the president instead of Bobby Kennedy, who, of course, they conveniently bumped off. And it's tempting to think that there's some link here, that it's not just an historical accident, that these things happen around the same time. It's tempting. Again, I don't want to be too Oliver Stone about it. I don't know that some, you know, mastermind or some Wizard of Oz kind of planned it all out in some big diabolical scheme. But it doesn't have to be that carefully planned. But it also, it seems to be crazy to think that that's mere accident, that it's simply really, really bad luck that these two insane things happened at the same time. There has to be an underlying link there. And that might be a kind of a fun sort of historical study for, you know, some of us to do together at some point as a collaboration. But if it sounds plausible to you guys, at least.
Absolutely. And I think there's other elements that we can introduce into this as well. Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. And the world, I'm turning inside out. Yeah. I'm floating around in ecstasy. So don't stop me now.
Having a good time, having a good time. I'm a shooting star leaping through the sky like a tiger, defying the laws of gravity. I'm a racing car passing by like Lady Godiva. I'm gonna go, 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 there's no stopping me. I'm burning through the sky, yeah. 200 degrees, that's why they call me Mr. Fahrenheit. I'm traveling at the speed
of... Speaking of kind of seeing through the BS, there's a lot of exciting grassroots social movement activity happening around advocacy for the Green New Deal, whether it be the Sunrise Movement or others that seem to be more emerging every day. I just wonder if we could wrap up by asking you to get you to share your impression or your sort of take on how that advocacy is going, what's working well, what's working best.
Yeah. So this is, I think, one of at some point historians are going to be writing about this as one of the most extraordinary and extraordinarily wonderful things that ever happened in this country and probably in the world. So, you know, I'm pretty tight with all of the movements that have been lately being named, in connection with the Green New Deal. So Sunrise on the one hand, Justice Democrats on the other hand, Brand New Congress, which morphed into New Consensus on yet another hand. All of these movements are just truly extraordinary. And of course, as you know, they're the ones who gave us AOC, and they're the ones who are probably going to give us 50 more AOCs in 2020, right? Now, these people who constitute these organizations are just beautiful, wonderful people. I've just never met more inspiring people in my life, especially in such a concentration, right? So what do they have in common? Well, a lot of them are millennials, not all of them, but a lot of them are. So part of this is generational. My understanding is that 2019 is the year that the millennials actually become officially the largest generation in the country, the largest sort of cohort, all while the baby boomers are finally beginning to dwindle because they're not replacing themselves, right? So that is the fact that what's now the largest cohort is disproportionately sort of represented by these movements, I think, is an important factor and probably is playing some role in the great success of the movement. Another thing that all of these organizations have in common is that they're very ethnically and gender diverse, right? It's not just a bunch of like old white guys who, you know, got degrees at the Kennedy School at Harvard or something. I mean, there's just such a diversity of backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, disciplinary backgrounds, you name it. And yet somehow, notwithstanding all of this diversity of background, there doesn't seem to be a single asshole among them. Like, everybody is just a beautiful, wonderful, generous-hearted human being, and at the same time, just an unbelievably smart, thoughtful human being, right? These are really smart, clever people who at the same time are not like, you know, oh, I'm smart, therefore I'm going to kind of, you know, lord it over this person or that person, or I'm going to, you know, I take pleasure in defeating people in arguments or debates or something. There's just this deep, earnest desire, it seems, to make this place a better place and to kind of undo all of the immense harm that's been done. There's also just this immense impatience with any of this kind of bullshit DLC incrementalism crap. You know, nobody wants to hear that shit anymore. And these, everybody I know in these movements is of this mind. And to me, this is just like, I'm in heaven, right? Because this has been my personality for as long as I've lived. And it's been very hard ever to find even individuals who sort of share that kind of sense of impatience and goodwill, like not wanting to be an asshole about it, you know, but wanting just to make the place better and to be able to say in a kind of a relatively civil way that incrementalism is not going to get us anywhere anymore. It took a long time even to meet like just individuals or pairs, small groups of people. And it's a very hard won battle just to find some like-minded people. And now all of a sudden, lo and behold, in a cohort that's behind me that's much younger than I am age-wise, it's like people like I've been looking for all my life are just abundant, right? So, you know, if these guys and gals are the sort of future of our polity, then, I mean, we're in better shape than we have ever been, right? Because even as great as as wonderful as many of the new dealers were, and as diverse as at least some of the new dealers were, it was still kind of a white dude thing, right, on balance. Even if, again, Frances Perkins was the first woman ever to be a cabinet official, and she really was, I think, the biggest of all of the big brains behind the New Deal, that's just one person, right? And she's like the exception, not the rule. But now, I think it's the diversity is the rule, not the exception, right? This thing is just it's as diverse, it's at least as diverse as the country as a whole is. And again, such smart and dedicated and earnest and just decent people. So I'm just thinking, I used to have this joke, you know, when I was younger, I used to say, well, I was born in the wrong century. I was either born too early or born too late. Now I'm definitely pretty sure I was born too early because these guys are so great that every time I hear a report now that some new medical advance has been made where they've discovered how to, you know, basically make people immortal, I sort of seize on it because I think I want to be around to live in the world that our millennial friends are going to make, because they're going to make an amazingly great world.
Well, some of the people that were in Dianne Feinstein's office were 7, 10 years old.
Yeah, so it's even, there was like a 6-year-old in there even.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old. I mean, these kids, and you probably watched the whole exchange. I mean, it wasn't just that they were like spunky and, you know, didn't back down. They were smart and thoughtful and well-spoken. I mean, they were at least as rhetorically acute as she was, even more so. And they seemed to understand physics better. Not physics, I'm sorry. They probably understand physics better than she does too, but I was thinking of, I meant civics, right? They seem to understand civics better than she did, you know?
It's an incredible sense of commitment too, and an unwillingness to be, you know, quieted.
Yeah. They weren't going to be like, I was trying to think of the right word. Like, what's the equivalent of mansplain? Would it be dinosaur splain or dinosplain? I mean, it was like, you know, sort of granny. I don't know what it is. Like, she was splaining to them, right? Splaining, like talking down to these, oh, don't worry your pretty little heads over this. You're just kids. I've been doing this for 30 years. And if I were one of those kids, and I probably would have said, well, that's the problem, man. I mean, 30 years, you know, move off, you know, move aside, man. Let us step up to the plate. It's, you know, your time is done. And again, I don't want to say that exactly, because there are a lot of people who have been in this even longer than Feinstein has, who are great. I mean, Bernie's obviously been at it for a very, very long time too. And he is still fresh, right? The guy is, you know, he has this just immense sense of possibility. So it's not so much an age thing or even a kind of how long have you been a politician thing necessarily, because we've got plenty of people who have been politicians for a long, long, long time who aren't like dinosaurs in the way that Feinstein is now. now, apparently. But there's definitely a dinosaur problem. you definitely have like people, some of them are young even, but who seem to think like the bee's knees is like, you know, Bill and Hillary circa 1992 or something. And if only we could go back to that. And you just want to say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, the time that we had Lloyd Bentsen as the Treasury Secretary who said, oh, you can't do, you know, you can't raise taxes on wealthy people because that's confiscatory, or you got to balance this budget because otherwise interest rates are going to go up and you're going to have a recession. And then, you know, Reaganomics that follow almost immediately after Bentsen leaves. I mean, that's not something to look back to happily. I mean, I think that's best, the charitable interpretation, I think, of that period even, which I think is when Feinstein actually became a senator. Didn't she enter about the same time as Barbara Boxer in like 92 or something?
Yeah, that was a year of the woman.
Yeah, the so-called year of the woman. I think, you know, what we should do is we should look back at that time as like an experiment that was, you know, maybe in, you know, maybe when we were, if you were actually present there and weren't just a kid like we were, you would have thought of it in good faith as worth trying. But I think that anybody who has good faith now has to recognize that that experiment utterly failed. And it wasn't just because of a bunch of bad faith Republican sort of rear guard actions. It was because incrementalism and ending welfare as we know it and austerianism and so forth was all just wrongheaded right from the get-go.
Well, Bob, it's been fantastic talking to you. Before we go, are there any other projects besides the Green New Deal that you are working on that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, just maybe a couple of things just really, really quickly. I mean, one is, as you guys know, I helped Senator Warren a lot with the Accountable Capitalism Act, and I hope to keep working on matters of that sort, both with Senator Warren and with Senator Sanders. I've done a lot of work for him of late of that sort. I hope to keep doing those kinds of things, whether or not one or both of them are president or co-presidents or something. And that connects back up to the more strictly financial stuff. And then finally, the second thing connects up with both, and that is, you know, as you, I think Scott knows, I've got a book coming out this year called A Republic of Owners, and it's basically designed to sort of show how we can very easily now, by taking charge publicly of finance and money again, foster the rapid spread of an economy whose basic organizational form, basic enterprise organizational form, is the worker co-op or is something like an employee-owned firm. We can actually do that quite realistically now in a way. We could have done it ages ago, but there was the sort of the state of, I think, money and sort of monetary and financial knowledge, at least among sort of mainstream types, was such as to make it look impossible. But it's now very clear, now that we understand money better than we did 10, 20 years ago, and now that we understand the way the financial system works better than we did 10 or 20 years ago, it's very clear that we can publicly facilitate through financial means a spread across the economy of worker-owned firms that would eliminate basically the sort of petty tyranny of the workplace, where we actually have worker self-determination, or what I think of as productive self-determination on the part of individuals and groups of individuals, as well as on the part of the polity as a whole. And the book is called A Republic of Owners. I'll send you guys the manuscript at some point. It's just about ready. And that's another thing. And I think this is in deep harmony with the Green New Deal. And it's in deep harmony with what Senator Sanders and Senator Warren tend to tout and in deep harmony with the work that I tend to do for them. So more to be said on that score. Our mutual friend Andres, as you know, does a lot of work on worker co-op type stuff. So he and I are having enjoying lots of wonderful conversations together about all of this.
That's Andres Bernal at the New School?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Andres over at the New School. So we've been conversing a lot about this and a lot about what the renewed understanding of the nature of money and the nature of the financial system teaches us that can be useful for the purpose of, again, you know, publicly facilitating or fostering the growth of what I think of as a producer's republic, right, where you actually have worker self-determination in the workplace in addition to citizen self-determination in the space of politics or in the space of public policy making.
Fabulous. Looking forward to those projects, that book. We might have to have you back to talk about that too. Thank you for joining us, Bob Hockett.
Thank you guys so much. What a joy. What a joy to talk with you guys.
for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing. And you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.